I painted my bedroom walls and ceiling a dark colour called Hague Blue, so it felt like a cavern, my own safe place. Later, however, the flat's privacy was a disadvantage. When I had a stalker, he was able to lurk around the flat undetected, eventually breaking into my house and threatening me. The flat was my home, but it also became my coke den and a kind of prison. I moved in and out of it over the years, for positive reasons, to move in with Sam, and for negative reasons, to escape feeling frightened and unprotected. But I've reclaimed it now and see it for what it is, a practical, convenient, affordable, and comfortable place for me and my kids to live. In the second half of 2009, I announced that I was retiring from the music business. More than anything, it was a good negotiating tactic to try and improve the terrible record deal that I'd accepted back in 2006. I was also desperate for a break. It felt like a natural time for me to take a step back from music and performing and do something else for a while. The idea of opening a shop selling clothes seemed hugely appealing. I had some money in the bank and I was beginning to reform a relationship with my sister Sarah, who loved clothes too, so, never one to shy away from a grand gesture, I presented her with this idea of opening a vintage clothes business together. Neither of us had any experience in business or retail, but we went ahead anyway. Things weren't easy between Sarah and me from the beginning. Sarah was born in 1979. She's 6 years older than me, and Mum always said that Sarah had longed for a little sister who she could dress up and who would look up to her and love her and be her playmate. Instead, she got me. I rejected the little sister role outright. As we grew up, Sarah and I developed different personalities, and yet we overlapped in lots of ways too. We both craved attention from men, especially. Neither of us had attentive dads. Sarah used her sex appeal as her currency, whereas for me, back then, it was about being accepted as one of the lads. You'd think we might have got on, given that we weren't in direct competition, but we didn't. I think Sarah was jealous of the respect that I got from boys, and I, in turn, was jealous of her looks and her clothes horse body. She could wear anything and make it look good. Clothes became a way of playing out our feelings, nicking them from each other, claiming them, spoiling them, losing them, not returning them. As I became successful, I acquired a lot of them. I was also at the centre of attention wherever I went. Getting attention for us as we grew up was a rare thing, and because it had been in short supply, its value was huge. Suddenly, I was getting showered with it. Sarah didn't care about me being a singer. She's never had any desire to be on stage, but the endless clothes that kept coming in, and what they represented, money, success, approbation. You deserve these things, Lily. Lily, please wear this. Lily, we love you. Lily, you're great. Lily, you look fantastic in this. Lily. Must have been hard to take. I resented Sarah for years. I loved her too. She's my sister. We know each other's history. We've been each other's witnesses. We know the weight of the baggage we both carry. Sarah is brilliant and funny and clever, and I wanted to repair my relationship with her. I wrote the song Back to the Start on my second album about her and our relationship. In it, I asked if we could start again. I thought that going into business together would be a way of doing that, a way of doing something together and carving out some kind of sweet future. Two sisters in business together, no exploitation or abuse or mind games, just selling lovely clothes. Even when I had very little money, I collected clothes. As I said before, as a teenager, I spent a lot of time in Portobello Market searching out stuff. It was never about being super chic. What excited me instead was mixing things up, hard with soft, rough with smooth, extravagance with thrift. I wasn't out looking for old Ozzie Clark dresses back then, but I was happy scoring Mickey Mouse jumbo or a pair of Stussy jeans, then pairing up my vintage finds with new sportswear. Nike white sports bras, baggy black hoodies and trainers. To sex it all up, I'd add a bit of bling. I wore layers of black eyeliner and lots of gold jewellery. My trick was knowing what worked for me. The prom dresses I wore when I first started singing suited my figure and covered the bits of my body I didn't like. I liked teaming them with unexpected accessories, a big gum pendant and Nike trainers, or Reebok Classics and a little Def Jam bomber. It's what I did with my music too. You hear lilting sunny tones as a song opens and you think you're going to hear something sweet, but what you might get is a song called Fuck You. My friends used to tear out pages from Vogue with photos of how they wanted to look, but I never did anything like that. To me, that was chasing something unattainable. Instead, I liked unpicking looks and making them my own. Rather than following any prescribed trend, I liked details too. That's how I formed my relationship with Chanel, by asking questions about the details I saw. I was invited to the shows initially simply because I was a celebrity who wore their label. I'd started shopping at Chanel as soon as I was rich enough. I'd buy a bag or a pair of shoes, and inevitably paparazzi photographs of me wearing the labels landed on Chanel's PR desk. Who is this girl? Karl Lagerfeld apparently asked his team when he happened to see one of the photographs. Why are we sending her all this stuff? We're not, the PR woman told Karl. She's buying it. After that, Chanel started inviting me to their shows, and I'm sure it would have stayed like that too, me going to a couple of shows a year for a period of time, if I hadn't got to know Karl. I met him by accident when I was DJing with Seb at an after-party following the September 2008 show. I was looking for the loo, and I stumbled into a room where Karl was sitting with his right-hand woman, Virginie. I'm sorry, I said as I started backing out of the room. Sorry, I was just looking for the loo, I jabbered, starstruck and feeling like I'd invaded an inner sanctum. But Karl and Virginie were relaxed and welcoming. No, they said. Please come in. The shoe was sitting there on the table in front of them. I'd been transfixed by it in the show because it had a jade disc midway down its heel that intrigued me. I couldn't work out how the heel could support any weight with that delicate circle implanted in it. I saw the shoe, and I said to Karl, please can you explain how the shoe works, because I don't understand the physics of it. Why doesn't the jade circle snap when the shoe is worn? Sit down, Karl said, and started to draw the shoe and the engineering behind it. It was the first time I'd talked to him properly. We chatted for a bit, and he told me how much he liked my music. It was relatively soon after that that I received a phone call asking me to be the face of Chanel for an advertising campaign. Receiving that phone call was a good moment for sure. It felt amazing. It felt like I'd won. And learning about Chanel and the clothes in more detail and how they are made only increased my respect for the craftsmanship that goes into couture in particular, but actually any piece of clothing that has been designed and made with care and thoughtfulness. To me, that's part of the lure of vintage. It's you putting together a look, and to do it well requires some imagination or effort. I was excited to pour all this enthusiasm into the shop. Lucy in disguise was a sweet idea, but good intentions didn't make Sarah and I natural business partners. Our shop didn't make financial sense from the start. We should have begun more slowly with fewer overheads, perhaps launching online and building up the business before paying rent on a big space in central London. But we let everything run away from us. Got too big too quickly, and we didn't run a tight enough ship. We got too much press, which created a lot of pressure, and had a documentary crew following us around the whole time too, which I hated, and which meant we had no space to try and feel our way forward. But the bottom line was that neither of us was good at running a business. I realised pretty quickly that we should cut our losses and close the business. I lost a lot of money with Lucy. I think it tallies out at about 1.5 million. I've been bad at dealing with money my whole life, and because I've always felt suffocated by the thought of dealing with it, I've let other people take charge of it. As a codependent, this came pretty easily to me. I know that this isn't a particularly healthy or helpful attitude, but at least it has always been counteracted by what I'm good at and what I do relish, which is working my arse off to earn it. Whatever else I've done, right or wrong, in my adult life, I've always been a provider, at first for myself, and then, later on in life, for my family. Love. I knew Sam for years before we ever got together. He was part of the Leicester crowd of my late teens. When we became a couple, the press often referred to him as Builder Sam Cooper or Sam Cooper Painter and Decorator, but Sam is posh. He runs a building company, but he's not up there on the ladder with a paintbrush in his hand. He was one of the guys on the boat with Lester when he dumped me from the other side of the world. They were all on a big gap year type trip, boys born into privilege, doing drugs and exploring the same hippie trail their bohemian parents had once marked out. Sam's is a big, sprawling, extended family, and unlike his brothers, Tarka, a musician who died tragically in 2008, and Barney, who runs a record label called Room 609. Sam didn't go into the music business or the arts. He's broken that mould. He isn't a labourer, but he grafts. He's built up his building company, Bonchurch, over more than 15 years of hard work. The first time I thought about Sam in that way was at a party I gave at Claridge's for my 24th birthday. It was a year after Tarka had died, and though I'd seen Sam at the funeral, I hadn't talked to him properly for ages. How is everything? I asked him, before taking him off to the loo. Not to do drugs, but because it was the only quiet place where we could talk. I wanted to talk to him. I wanted to talk to him for hours and hours. I wanted, I realised, to talk to him for the rest of my life. Nothing happened between us that night, but it was then that I first thought, oh my God, Sam. Before that, I'd liked Sam, but I'd never thought about him romantically. Suddenly it felt imperative that I see him again. And soon. And so I invited him and a couple of mutual friends to Glastonbury to watch me a few weeks later. They came. Sam says he knew something was going to happen when a group of us were sitting in the back of the people carrier on the way to the helicopter port, Go, Glasto. And I put up my feet to rest across his legs. That's when he realised, he later told me, that I was definitely flirting with him. He was right. I was definitely flirting. I liked him a lot. I remember thinking, this, just being with this person is exciting. Being in the same room as this person is exciting. I remember also thinking, I'm going at a million miles an hour and my life is chaotic and I can't carry on like this for much longer. And this man seems like he can offer me a different way to go forward. And it's a better way. Still, I didn't take Sam's way forward immediately. As I said, it wasn't long after Glastonbury that I left London for Japan to play the Fuji Rock Festival. Sam had lodged himself into my head, but not yet into my life. In my life, I was still rushing, drinking, drugging, and shagging around, and in pretty plain view of Sam, too, because the adage, what happens on tour stays on tour, didn't appear to be watertight. Photos appeared in the papers showing me drunk and out of it. In one of them, I'm leaning in to kiss a guy I met at Fuji, a guy called Wade from the band The Virgins. Sam, waiting for me back home, saw the photo in one of the tabloids. He didn't like it. He called me up and laid things out. I really like you, he said. I really want to be with you, but I can't cope with your behaviour. If you want to be with me, you have to stop. I loved that Sam was so straightforward. Right, I thought. Okay, then, I'll stop and I'll put myself in Sam's corner. I'll change, I said to him. I'll stop running around, but you have to promise to look after me. Somewhere in my head, my thinking went, if I can get someone else to help me cope with everything, then I won't have to use drugs and alcohol to get me through. Even though we'd hardly spent any real time together, as soon as Sam said that he wanted to be with me, I went to get his keys and made calls to arrange someone renting out my Queen's Park flat. I'm here now, I told him, presenting my whole self to him. You're taking care of me. Sam and I were together for 6 years. I can't write about all the good times with him, because we're not together anymore. I made a conscious decision to end our relationship, and I can't relive those moments. It's not that I'm choosing not to, or at least not on a conscious level, but I can't access them anymore. My brain has shut them off. Of course we had good times. We had a proper marriage. We looked after each other. Listened to my songs, Life for Me, Close Your Eyes, As Long as I've Got You, or Latecomer. They're all love songs, and they were all written for Sam about our life together. Sam and I loved each other, and we had important stuff in common too. We both went through our parents divorcing when we were four. We've both got lots of siblings, most of them born as a result of our parents having further relationships with other people. We were both a little bit the black sheep of our families, the ones who'd been underestimated and became unexpectedly successful. I remember Mia, Sam's mum, saying to him when we got together, I would never have put money on you, Sam, to be the one who ended up with a famous girlfriend and being part of the showbiz scene. Never in my wildest dreams did I think it would be you. I remember thinking, what are you talking about? Sam is funny. He made me laugh. We've got a similar stupid sense of humour. He's also neurotic. He's a control freak. He's a forward planner. He likes to know what he's doing weeks in advance. He's quite traditional. He was a safe pair of hands, and I needed that. I loved that he didn't overreact about things. He was calm. He didn't do drama. Quite soon after we got together, I overslept at his house and I missed a dance rehearsal for something important. I think it was my performance at the Brit Awards. I was always nervous about those kinds of performances, and because I was late, my anxiety fizzed into fury and I took it out on Sam. You didn't fucking set the alarm, I yelled. It's your fucking fault. He didn't react. He didn't shout back or castigate me for being ridiculous and a nightmare drama queen. He just ignored me and let it go. He didn't bring it up later, didn't hold it against me, didn't let it escalate. That was a new experience for me. It was a relief. As soon as Sam and I got together, we nested. We lived in his flat on Great Titchfield Street in Marylebone. In the evenings, I cooked, and we went to the pub, or sometimes to Groucho's. At weekends, we watched the cricket, which we both loved. One weekend, my dad and his wife Tamsin left my three-year-old sister Teddy with us to look after while they went away. I remember the three of us sleeping in the bed together and thinking, I want this. I like this. It was like a practice run-through, a foreshadowing of our own little family. I moved into Sam's flat in October 2009. A few months later, we bought a flat together in Great Portland Street and moved there. By May 2010, I was pregnant with George. Marriage. When I became pregnant with my first child, George, I didn't know much, but I knew two things for sure. I knew that I had to protect my baby, and I knew that I had to get out of London. As soon as we knew we were going to have a baby, Sam and I started looking for a place in the countryside. Living in London and being surrounded by the media had always felt oppressive, but once I was pregnant, it became untenable. I knew I didn't want my child to grow up in an environment that included photographers camping outside my house or following me around as I went about my day-to-day life. Sam and I looked at a lot of places, many of them lovely, but as soon as I saw Overtown, I knew it was the house for us. It was just what you might imagine a lovely Cotswold house to look like. A sprawling, low-lying, 17th century house built from pale Cotswold stone with huge fireplaces in nearly every room, a cottage that became my studio, and a couple of barns beside the main house. The best thing about it for us, though, was its location. The house was set well away from the road, down a long drive, and so it felt completely private. It looked out onto the Slad Valley, so you couldn't see a house or telegraph pole for miles. The views from it were incredible. It was at Overtown, when I was 6 months into a relatively easy pregnancy, that I noticed I was spotting and bleeding a bit. Sam was in London working, but as I was due for a scan in a matter of days anyway, my obstetrician said it would be as well to push the scan forward and do it immediately. Spotting needn't be any cause for alarm, she said over the telephone, but it seemed prudent to come in early and to check everything was okay with the baby. I drove to London the next day and met Sam at the Portland Hospital, where I was registered to have our baby and where I was having all my antenatal care. I had an external scan and everything looked fine. The baby was moving around happily. The specialist who was doing the scan asked if he could do a quick internal examination. "Oh," he said, looking at me, somewhat surprised. "Your cervix is already dilated. You may not have had any contractions, but technically, if you're dilated, you're in labour." "Oh, I was 28 weeks and 2 days into my pregnancy, so the baby was officially viable, but still labour." "Really? Babies born earlier than 28 weeks can still be fine," I was told, and there was no need to panic. The hospital would do all they could to prevent the baby being born this early, as every day he was inside me would give me a stronger chance of delivering a perfectly healthy baby. There were lots of positives to the situation, and yet I remember sitting next to Sam and holding his hand and thinking, this isn't going to end right. It was a secret thought, tiny and dark, and I pushed it aside. I'd just seen my baby on the monitor, kicking about, alive and well. I was being transferred to the labour ward, and there were practical things that could and should be done. The first was to make a decision. The doctor said, "What we really want to do is prevent your waters breaking. But we have to be prepared for the fact that you could go into full-blown labour at any point. The bad news is that we're only a level 2 hospital, so we don't have the appropriate facilities to look after the baby if he does come soon. We have to make a decision about whether to keep you here or move you somewhere else." No one seemed able to make that decision. I didn't want to be the one making the decision, and it seemed weird to me that no one was taking charge. Surely it would be sensible to transfer me to the nearest level 1 hospital with all the necessary facilities. I knew that UCL was minutes away from the Portland. Couldn't I go there? I couldn't. UCL didn't have the space to take me. Then the question became, what do we do now? That was when I realised that because I was famous and also in potential trouble, I was a problem. No one wanted Lily Allen to deliver her baby too early on their watch. What I wanted was support and reassurance, but instead I felt alone and isolated. The decision was finally made to transfer me by ambulance to the Homerton Hospital in Hackney. It took an hour and a half to get there, but once I was there, action began to be taken. This was reassuring. I was put in a bed that was tilted downward so that my head was below my navel and my feet above. This was to help defy gravity and prevent the baby from pressing down on my cervix. I was then taken to emergency surgery to have a stitch put in to help hold my cervix together. I was told point blank that there was no way that I was leaving the hospital until I had the baby. I had 3 months left until I reached full term. Fine, I thought. I'll get settled in. Sam went to M&S and bought lots of nice food to stock up the fridge in my room. My dad bought me an easel and some watercolours because he was going through an art phase at the time. My mum and my sister and my brother visited me and ate jerk chicken that they'd picked up from the Caribbean takeout place they'd found near the hospital. Sam set up a camp bed next to my tilted bed. It was all going to be fine. And it was fine, for a time. The stitch held. It held for a week and a half. It held until one night Sam made me laugh and I felt it go ping. That's when the fluid started leaking out of me. My waters hadn't broken, but they were bulging, and I was now in labour proper. The theory was that prior to the spotting, I had a really bad toothache, which led to an infection, which then got into my bloodstream, which then infected my waters, thus causing them to rupture. Then there was another theory. I might have strep B, so I was pumped full of antibiotics, because if you deliver a baby when you've got strep B, it can be dangerous for the child. But even with the strep B worry, it was still, you're going to have a baby, albeit prematurely, and it's all going to be fine. Sam was given a tour of the neonatal unit, where the baby would be taken as soon as he was born, and we were told to prepare ourselves for him to be immediately whisked away and incubated. We understood. We were having our baby. I was in labour all night. In the morning, the midwife said, "You're crowning. We can see the baby's head, not long now." Then sometime later, I don't know how long, maybe it was 5 minutes, but it could have been 5 hours, she said, "The cord is wrapped around the baby's neck. There was a pulse, now there isn't. There is no pulse now." That meant the baby was dead. He wasn't out of my body yet, but they knew. They called it. He was dead. I could feel his little head between my legs, but my contractions weren't strong enough to push him all the way out. The doctors told me they couldn't pull him out with forceps or use a Ventouse because doing that would rip him apart. He was too small, too underdeveloped for those things. The only thing to do was pump me full of drugs to help increase my contractions. I was warned that these drugs would make me very sick and that it would still take time for them to work. My baby was dead. I couldn't escape the enormity of that. He was physically stuck, not quite outside me, not safe inside either. I was physically stuck too. I hadn't been able to keep him inside me, and now I couldn't deliver him. For 10 hours between my baby dying and getting him out, I entered a realm I'd never been to before. It's a realm I cannot describe, or revisit, even if I wanted to. The sickness I was experiencing was consuming. I felt knocked out. I felt not human. George was born that evening. He was cleaned up and wrapped in a blanket and a little hat, and Sam and I held him for a long time. We took photographs. We had our little babe and he was in our arms. It's just that he wasn't alive. Then the doctors put me to sleep. In the morning, we were discharged. The hospital needed the bed. For me, the journey home without my baby was the saddest, most surreal hours of my life. A mixtape that Sam had made was playing in the car at the time, and all the songs felt relevant to our situation. The Etta James song, "I'd Rather Go Blind," was one of the songs, and it became my soundtrack. It became the soundtrack to losing George. I don't remember how we got through the days. I remember how I got through the nights. I hadn't been drinking or smoking while I was pregnant, but my self-destructive genes came roaring back to life, in spite of Sam, who was doing all he could each and every day to help me cope with, i.e. get through the nights, because certainly I couldn't sleep. I'd go to bed with Sam and I'd wait for him to go to sleep. Then I'd go down to the kitchen, open a bottle of red wine and drink it while smoking a packet of cigarettes. I remember feeling numb, so numb, and doing whatever that version of crying is when you don't make a sound but become sodden with constant tears. That was my routine for months. I remember one day in particular, Sam was working. It was raining, torrential, biblical rain. I went outside, took my clothes off and got down on the grass and just lay there. I don't know how long I stayed there, nor can I explain why I did it, or even if it helped. I felt like I was in total darkness. I felt like my life was black, pure black. If I'd been in a city, I'm sure I would have started going out and taking drugs to cope with the blackness, and who knows how I would have ended up. But I wasn't, and I didn't. I was in Gloucestershire, in the rain, going mad. I got ill, really ill. 5 days after George died, my best friend Jess came to help look after me. I was feeling ropey, but because I couldn't differentiate between physical pain and emotional pain at that point, I didn't notice that I was running a high fever. Jess did, and she kept trying to get me to see a doctor. I refused. I told her I didn't want to see any doctors ever again. Even when my ex-stepdad, Harry, turned up, took one look at me and said, "You need to go to a doctor now," I still refused. Somehow, between them, Jess, Sam and Harry got a doctor to the house that night. He immediately sent me to hospital. I had septicemia. Mum knew immediately what it must be causing my blood to be poisoned. It's obvious, there must be some of the placenta still inside her and it's infected her blood. But no one seemed to agree with her and she had to bully the hospital into giving me a scan. Where else do you have an ultrasound scan of your womb but the maternity ward of a hospital? And who else is waiting there except happy couples holding hands and waiting for their standard 3-month scans or 5-month checkups? And there was me, on a wheelie bed, waiting beside them, only I wasn't pregnant. I'd been holding my dead child in my arms only days before. My mum was right. They did the scan and the placenta was inside me. I had to have a D&C, dilation and curettage, to remove it. Even that wasn't straightforward, Because they were doing the operation so soon after I'd given birth, my womb lining was extremely fragile, and there was a risk, they told me, just before I was put under general anaesthetic, that in removing the placenta, my womb lining might get so damaged that a hysterectomy would then be inevitable. Oh, really? I remember thinking, a hysterectomy, whatever. I didn't think, oh no, I don't want a hysterectomy. I just thought, I don't want this life anymore. My life has always seemed so full of extremes, extreme highs and extreme lows. I've often been told it's extremely unlikely that this will happen or that will happen, but everything always does happen, however unlikely the odds. I probably won't need a stitch in my cervix, I was told, but I did. You most likely won't go into labour too early, they said, but I did. The baby will almost certainly survive, said the doctors, but he didn't. I remember thinking when George died, maybe this is God's plan. Maybe I'm meant to go through all this pain. Maybe I'm meant to write about it. Maybe it will make me a better artist. I tried to rationalise it, because if you can make even a semblance of sense of something, you hope that the pain and the mystery of it will become more manageable. Because it is a mystery, losing a baby. You're pregnant for so long, and then just as you're experiencing the miracle of new life, poof, your child is gone, utterly vanished, leaving behind only the faintest of imprints on the world, and it's all over. It feels like your life is over. But you can't rationalise losing a child, and your life isn't over. You just keep going, very slowly. You piece yourself somewhat back together and get on with stacking the dishwasher and loading the laundry and making the dinner and then, yes, working or writing or attending to your marriage or eventually embarking again on family life. Your lost child is there with you, always, this beautiful negative space inside you forever. George died in October, soon after Sam proposed. We'd gone to Bali straight after Christmas to try and recover a bit. And on New Year's Eve, Sam told me that he'd organised a special dinner on the beach. It wasn't quite the romantic occasion he'd imagined. The heavens opened and the wind blew and it pissed with rain. Sam disappeared for 20 minutes in the middle of the dinner. Sand blew in the food, drinks fell over and food flew all over the place. I figured a proposal was coming. It was part of Sam's way of trying to fix me. I was in a dark place after George died and it didn't feel like that dark place would ever end. Sam knew that if he proposed to me, it would give me something to focus on. He figured I would get excited about planning my wedding, and he was right. More immediately, why else would we be sitting on the beach in the rain with him in fluster? I was like, okay, can you hurry up and pop the question so we can go back to bed? Sam had disappeared. It transpired because he'd gone to call my dad to ask permission to marry me. He'd had a last-minute freak-out about not squaring it with Keith. Now that he was seeking duty of care, Keith didn't hesitate, not that that duty was high on Keith's list when it came to us, nor did I. I said yes immediately, like it was ever in me to say no. I was in love with Sam, but even if I hadn't wanted to marry him, I would have said yes, because I would have found it too awkward to say no. Saying no might have hurt Sam's feelings. It's not that I didn't want to marry Sam. I did, desperately. It's just that who the fuck knows what that want was about. Was it about forming a proper life with someone and running into the future together as a team? Or was it about attaching myself to him so that someone else could now officially take up the reins of my life? Sam and I got married near Overtown on the 11th of June 2011 at St. James's Church in Cranham, Gloucestershire. I had two dresses. The one I wore for the ceremony and which was in all the public photographs was by a French designer called Delphine Manivet. The second one, which I wore for the reception, was designed specifically for me by Karl Lagerfeld and made by Chanel. I was 3 months pregnant when I got married, and I felt awkward about telling Karl the news. I thought he might be pissed off by the inconvenience of my size changing and having to alter the dress. I was nervous too because I didn't know what sort of wedding dress Karl was making. It's not like he offers to make you a dress and then you talk through the ideas and he shows you the sketches. No, he just says, don't worry, I'll handle it and it'll be beautiful. He was right. His dress was perfect, and it fitted like a glove. I loved it entirely, but it arrived just 24 hours before the wedding, and that's cutting it fine for a bride. By then, I'd formed a relationship with Delphine, who I'd commissioned to make a backup dress so that I'd have something to wear if Carl's didn't fit me or arrive in time. I preferred Carl's dress, but I wore Delphine's dress for the ceremony out of loyalty because we'd been together so much while she fitted it and made it. It's typical of me, even on my wedding day, to wear a dress I loved less to appease somebody that I then never saw again. My sister Sarah's outfit was the one that got the most attention in the press, however. She was accused of upstaging the bride because what she wore was so revealing. Her outfit was like a signpost to her boobs. I had known what she was planning to wear. Mum and Sarah and I all stayed at the hotel the night before the wedding, and Sarah tried on 3 different outfits and showed them to us. She looked great in 2, but seemed determined to wear the most outlandish and least flattering. My mum and I were both like, maybe that last one where your tits are out is a bit inappropriate. But she ignored us and went for it anyway. I didn't care. Sam and I had a ball at our wedding. We flew over the Cajun singer Warren Storm and his Zydeco band, the Little Band of Gold, from Louisiana, and Sam and I did our first dance to their song, Before I Grow Too Old. That song was important for us. Joe Strummer had done a cover of it that I'd always loved, and when I played Joe's version to Sam, he knew it immediately. Not only that, but he knew and loved the original version because he'd had a friend who played in the Little Band of Gold. As soon as he played it for me, I loved it too, and so even though it was an extravagance flying a legendary singer and a band over from Louisiana to perform at a wedding, we didn't really hesitate. They were worth it. They were fantastic and played for 9 hours straight. It was that kind of party. It didn't stop. After Little Band of Gold, Seb and Theo both DJed. The music went on and on. Everyone said it was the best party they'd ever been to, and I loved it too. At least the bit of it I managed to stay up for. Because I was pregnant, I wasn't drinking or smoking, and by 11 o'clock I was exhausted. Sam took me to bed and tucked me in, but then fell asleep in his clothes next to me. We woke at 7 the next morning, and we looked out of the window. We could see the party still going on, and all our friends in their party clothes around the campfire. Let's just stay in bed, we said to each other. Let's stay together in bed and let the party carry on without us. After the wedding and the party, Sam and I got on the Eurostar to go to Paris for our honeymoon. We didn't want to be fancy schmancy. We wanted to hold hands and go to museums and cafes and wander about doing nothing much, but we couldn't do any of that. We were chased by photographers everywhere we went, so after a couple of days, we got the train home, back to Gloucestershire, where the first thing I did was change my name. I didn't want to be Lily Allen anymore. I was done with her and what she'd become. She had tired me right out. I was Mrs. Cooper now. Motherhood. When I was a teenager and was trying to figure out what I was going to do with my life, I remember thinking back, in my fog of hopelessness, to a specific moment in 1991. I was on set in Wales with my dad when he was working on a film called Rebecca's Daughter. He and I were staying in a hotel, and at 6:30 a.m. we were woken up, as Dad was every morning, by a production assistant coming in, running a bath, and handing my dad a cup of coffee with a cheery greeting. I watched this ritual and I thought, when I grow up, I need a job that comes with someone like this. It was an outlandish ambition, given that I found it hard to do anything much back then. Never mind hold down any job for long. But even so, whenever I tried to contemplate my future as a young teen, that's what would enter my head. The realization that I needed to be nannied, professionally and personally. And so it came to pass. I've had an assistant since I was 21. You find what you need. There's one reason I loved as well as hated fame at the beginning of my career. Managers and assistants come as part and parcel with it, and I loved handing over control to them, as well as to lovers and friends. Fame at the beginning also gave me a sense of affirmation that I longed for. I found it on stage and when people responded to songs. Sometimes people told me that my lyrics struck a chord or that I'd identified a feeling or got something right. Hearing that meant someone was listening to me and liked what I was saying, and I loved that. I think that's why I was so devastated when I felt fame let me down. Instead of laughing about the shit I read about myself or ignoring it, which I can do now, I felt betrayed. That's a dangerous cycle to get into. Rely on fame for anything. What a joke. No wonder I was so eager to cast it off when I handed myself over to Sam and became Mrs. Cooper. I'm done with you now, fame, I might as well have declared. You were a crap carer and a shitty lover. You didn't nurture me one bit. You were two-faced and you bullied me, and it turned out I couldn't get you to look after me at all. But I'm off to the countryside with Sam now, and I don't need to be even one bit famous because he's promised to look after me and all my needs. I'm going to be Lily Rose Cooper, and I'm going to live in a house with roses over the door and dogs on the sofa and a roast in the oven, and I'm going to have plenty of healthy babies, and Sam and I are going to live happily ever after. At least that's what I thought back then as I settled into married life as Mrs. Cooper. That, at least, was the plan. Ethel was born on 25th of November 2011. She was tiny and ginger and perfect. While we were still in the delivery room with Ethel on my chest, our umbilical cord not yet cut, Sam's phone rang. It was one of those sacred moments. Your baby's first breaths outside your womb. But right in the middle of it was my press agent on the phone saying, "You've had a girl, right? I've got the mail on the other line and they want me to confirm it." We ignored the press, but told everyone in our own world our happy news. People were thrilled. Losing a child is a deeply personal thing, but it affects everyone around you. It sets off alarm bells in the collective unconscious, as well as upsetting people on more straightforward levels. Babies are supposed to renew our life cycle, not arrive already dead. The birth of another child reassures people. For Sam and me, Ethel didn't lessen the hole that George left, but her birth provided a kind of riposte to what before had been an unanswerable, unassailable loss. Sam's mum, Mia, seemed relieved in her particular own way. "Well," she said when Sam told her about her new granddaughter, "at least we know Lily can have babies now." I had my baby, indeed. She wasn't as healthy as she should have been, but she was alive, and she was mine. She was mine and Sam's beautiful bubba. Ethel was born with laryngomalacia. That meant her upper larynx collapsed on itself every time she inhaled, and that collapsed larynx in turn obstructed her airway. She could breathe, but only with immense effort. She couldn't manage to take much milk in either. A baby who doesn't feed is hugely worrying for a mum. All I wanted to do was sit with her in my arms and have her latch onto my boob. That didn't happen. Ethel couldn't breastfeed because of her breathing difficulties. I pumped my milk instead, hoping she would drink that from a bottle. She didn't. Mostly I donated it, and even formula wasn't much of a success. What I did get down her, she vomited up almost immediately. She lost weight as the weeks went by. By February, she was ready for the first of two operations to have her aryepiglottic folds trimmed, which would help her breathe and in turn feed. I hated the idea of Ethel having surgery, but I was desperate for her to get the help that she needed. We were both unhappy. She was hungry and tired from the effort of breathing, and I felt rejected as a mum. I was almost certainly suffering from postnatal depression, which went undiagnosed because I was determined not to admit how bad I felt. If I did ever think about it, I'd assume I felt bad because I was worried about Ethel and her health. I didn't realise that these things, childbirth, exhaustion, worry, feeling rejected by my baby, not being able to breastfeed, could actually affect my brain chemistry and thus trigger depression, something which I could have, and looking back, should have got more help with. After the operations, Ethel's breathing was much improved, but, if anything, she was even more resistant to feeding. She was done with people messing with her mouth and nose. We were told we'd have to feed her via a tube while she slept. I was taught how to insert the tube so it went right down into her tummy and was then taped across her face and to her back. You had to make sure that you'd got it in the right place by using a syringe inside the tube to draw out a few drops of fluid, then testing a drop or two on some litmus paper to make sure the acidity on the tube came from her stomach. Even so, often after you'd fed her, she'd wake up vomiting, so you'd have to wait until she was asleep again before restarting the process, silently willing the milk that was slowly dribbling down the tube to stay down, to get absorbed by her little system and help Ethel grow. The whole process was horrible. It took two people to get the tube into her, but if you were alone and the tube came out, you just have to get on with things. Pin her down and get it back in by yourself. I loathed having to do this. Every so often, I'd still try her on my best. I'd sit squishing her face into my boob and she'd look at me as if to say, "What do you think I'm going to do with that?" When she was 8 months old, I'd had enough. I was pregnant again, and I think knowing there was another baby on the way made me determined to tackle the situation. I took the tube out of Ethel's mouth and gently peeled away the tape from her face and neck. "We're going to do this, Ethel," I told her, "you and me." It took three anxiety-ridden days before Ethel started feeding normally, but eventually she started drinking from the bottle. After that, we didn't look back. My beautiful Marnie was born on 8th of January 2013. It was an easy birth. She was healthy and fed easily from the beginning. Our little family was now complete, and it was time for me to go back to work. We needed the money, and I wanted to write and record music again. Gradually, over the next 2 years, our little family started to come apart. I shouldn't have left the nest. I had to leave the nest. I wanted to leave the nest. I wish I hadn't left the nest. Work, Part 3. If writing my second album came easily, the same cannot be said about the third. Fuck no. It was like, how do I do that again, With my second album, It's Not Me, I'd felt independent, I'd felt sexy, I'd felt like I owned myself, at least at times. When it came to album three, I had kids. One of them had died. I was married. I was living in a house in the country. I was bringing up babies. I was a different person, wasn't I? Was I? Who was I again? I was a mum, first and foremost, but I was still in my mid-twenties and I realised I'd hardly begun my professional life. I wanted to get back to it. I was glad to be a mother, but I realised I wanted to work too. Looking after tiny children is relentlessly tiring and at times extremely tedious. I sometimes laughed about that later on when I was on tour. Why have you come back to work, people would ask, after having kids? Because motherhood is so boring, I joked, a line which was then seized on by the Daily Mail and became a story about how Lily Allen was now bored of motherhood, as if it were a hobby I'd taken up and put down again. There is nothing boring about actual motherhood. That role, I discovered, is challenging and surprising and rewarding and hard. And it comes hotwired to love and pain and worry and joy. But yeah, the daily tasks that mothering small children requires, much of that is beyond boring. That's one reason why it's so fucking tough. It's about looking after someone else's needs and leaving yours to one side. That's a hard ask for a narcissist. No wonder my dad didn't bother with it. I wanted to go back to work because I felt stifled creatively. But working also seemed an easier option in many ways than the grinding task of tending to two very small children. I wrote most of my third album, Jesus, in the small library room at home in Overtown. I'd sit in a chair in one corner of the room, and whoever I was working with, Greg Kirsten mostly, and sometimes a producer called Friars, who became a friend, had their computer and equipment on the other side. We'd shut the door and write all day, sometimes into the night, because the record company didn't have to pay for studio space. They'd sprung for a chef to cook for us every evening. The kids were looked after by a nanny. I could often hear them wanting to come in and be with me. They were little back then. Ethel was one, Marnie a baby. I know. Get over it, right? It's the struggle of every working parent. However much you long for work or embrace going back to it, leaving your kids, especially when they are young, is hard. The great advantage of writing Jesus at home meant that I could see the girls whenever I took a break. That was a huge luxury. The downside was that I could hear and sense them near me all the time. It didn't help me separate work from my role as a mother. The thing is, I don't really see that I should have had to. At least not so much. I wanted to work, yes, but I also had to go back to earning money. We had massive mortgage payments to meet, and we employed people to help us manage our lives. Our overheads were huge. This is not a complaint. We didn't have to live like that. It was a luxury we chose, but it also had to be paid for. And, as the family's biggest breadwinner, the onus was on me to support the family financially. I didn't resent doing the work, and though I found it painful to separate myself from the girls, I also understood that writing music while paying someone else to look after my children was a privilege and a choice. The bit I didn't understand and still find hard to comprehend is why I, as a writer and recording artist, couldn't celebrate my role as a mother more. Why are so many songs about looking for love or falling in love or losing love, but not about sustaining love or familial love? Why is the role of being a parent pretty much airbrushed out in the entertainment industry? Why, if you are a young female pop artist, is it so crucial to be always sexy, desirable, and implicitly available? Instead, I felt this unspoken pressure. There was always a lot of eye-rolling at my record label whenever I tried to balance out my working schedule to include seeing my kids, to almost pretend that I didn't have kids at all. These were the issues I was struggling with as I wrote my third album, and they are the issues I continue to struggle with today. I find I can now face the issue a bit more squarely. I can't solve it, but at least I can grapple with it with more confidence. But back in 2013, the dichotomy between going back to work as a pop artist and being a mother to two very young children wasn't something that I could examine with any distance or objectivity. It was right inside me. It was my waking, daily reality, and I found it blinding. I look back at photographs from Jesus and I think, that person there, all dressed up, her hair, all those crazy colours. Surely mums don't do that. Crop tops, showing off a flat stomach. No way three babies came out of that, right? That person is having an identity crisis. I didn't come up with my look for Jesus. I'm interested in the visual side of my work, of course, but I told myself that I didn't have time to sit around and create mood boards. I left that side of things to a stylist called Amy Phillips, who became my creative consultant throughout the whole Jesus period. She was in charge of how my hair and makeup looked, what I wore in the videos and my tour costumes. In other words, I handed over my entire image to someone else, and it wasn't because I didn't have time, I now realize, but because I had lost sense of my own identity. If you don't know who you are in yourself. I'm a mum, but not just a mum. I'm a performer, but for years I hadn't performed. I'm still young, but not so young, and not in terms of the music industry. I'm married, but that's not something that's particularly celebrated in an industry which values availability above stability. And it's hard to know how to present yourself to the outside world, and especially hard to decide on how you're going to encapsulate it all on an album cover. I'm more wary about that now. I learned a lot about letting other people make decisions for you with Sheezus, especially with the first song from it, Hard Out Here. The label didn't like it that Hard Out Here used the word bitch so much. One executive in America sent a long email arguing why I should lose some of the references. He'd counted the number of times I'd used the word. I don't think a female would like another woman calling her a bitch, he wrote. How about the female that wrote the song? Why do you think she's using the word bitch? Bitch? What's insane is that he had listened to the song clearly forensically, but somehow the song's irony, its whole central point, had gone over his head. That, it turned out, would be the least of it. When the song came out in November 2013, the immediate response to it was positive. Hard Out Here is exactly what we wanted from a Lily Allen comeback, wrote The Guardian. This is not just a pop song, rallied The Observer. This is a feminist text with a really catchy drum beat. This is not just a pop song. This is an open letter to the male online. This is a cackling wink at modern misogyny, at women's roles in 2013. The Observer was right. I'd written the song about sexism in the music industry because I was sick of being expected to look and behave a certain way. I was sick of having my body inspected, and I was sick of sexy face. It sickened me that as a woman I was expected to make sexy face. No one expected my male peers to do it. Just as no one wrote about how thin or fat they might be looking on any particular day. I wanted the video to reflect the song's sentiment and hard-edged anger. I wanted it to show exactly what women singers are expected to do in videos and at the same time undermine that expectation. And I wanted to do it with humour as well as rage. I started becoming preoccupied by how much I weighed and how thin I had looked when I became famous. There was a direct correlation between my success and my increasingly unhealthy relationship with food. It started towards the end of album one when I started doing more photo shoots for fashion magazines rather than straightforward press photographs. When you start appearing on the cover of Elle Mexico, say, or GQ magazine, expectations about you and your body change. You walk into a studio and you can see from the rails of clothes that the fashion editor in charge of the shoot has already spent quite a lot of time sizing up your body. You're never thin enough. As well as that, you see photographs of yourself in the Daily Mail or Heat magazine, along with other female celebrities. You're being compared to them, sometimes positively, sometimes negatively. One day you might be chastised for having cellulite and letting yourself go. The next you're being praised in some awful, pointed, equally misogynistic way for your curves and for rejecting plastic surgery. It's all awful. It shouldn't be allowed. I don't even have to write about how insidious and disgusting and ridiculous and unfair it all is. This way of treating and mistreating and judging the female body. We all know. But on it goes. I feel angry about it now, and these days I take boxing lessons to keep in shape. Go figure. But for years, my every waking day was shadowed by a preoccupation with my size. What a waste of headspace. What a waste of consciousness. What an insult to every person struggling with illness or poverty or homelessness. What a diss to the sunshine and the sky and the birdsong and to any number of small pleasures or preoccupations that could have more joyfully and usefully occupied space taken up with worry about body weight. But there we are. I was a young woman and I became one of the many young women who self-harm in order to weigh less. It started with bulimia. I began making myself sick as attention heated up with my second album. In my case, it was a direct result of having my body constantly scrutinized. I'd sit in restaurants and as soon as I'd finished eating, I'd be like, fuck, how soon can I get to the loo? I'd weigh things up. Do I have too much makeup on to make myself sick? I carried little bottles of eye makeup remover and cotton buds in my handbag so that if my eyes streamed too much from making myself sick, I could touch up my makeup, or I'd just make sure I ate less. It got to the point that I didn't even try to hide it from Sam. I made it part of a pre-gig ritual that we both accepted as normal. Oh, I'd say, I can't sing on a full stomach. I get that acid reflux thing, you know. I should have waited to eat till after the show. Then I'd excuse myself and make myself vomit. I had other strategies too. I drank a lot of coffee and smoked a lot of cigarettes in order to suppress my appetite. I took cocaine for the same reason. If I was going out for dinner, I'd take coke earlier than everyone else to stop myself eating. Sometimes, if I had a photo shoot coming up, I'd purposefully go on a bender the night before, because someone had told me that your body, dehydrated of water, shrinks after you've drunk a lot of alcohol. I flirted with Adderall, which is really just a type of speed, as a way of getting or staying thin. Once I had access to prescription drugs through the RockDocs contacts that I built up in my address book. RockDocs are those private doctors that the industry knows are happy to issue prescriptions for sleeping pills and painkillers without asking too many questions. Or worse, back before I was a mum, if I had 3 days off, say, I'd take a succession of sleeping pills to stop myself eating. I'd lock myself in my flat, take an industrial strength pill to knock myself out, wake up 12 hours later and neck another, and so on, until 3 days had passed and I could emerge 3/4 of a stone lighter. When I shot the video for Hard Out Here, I was still carrying a lot of baby weight after having Marnie 8 months earlier. I'd become huge while I was pregnant. When Sam and I started our family, I'd stopped drinking and drugging and made myself sick. I wasn't supposed to take any strenuous exercise because of my pregnancy history, and I was still suffering from depression from losing George, and then postnatally with Ethel. And so mostly I just took to my bed and ate obsessively. Sam would go to work and I'd go to the newsagent, buy 5 packets of biscuits and then sit or lie around all day eating them while I watched episodes of ER. I watched every episode of every series of ER. I watched every episode of The West Wing 2. I watched every episode of that show at least 4 or 5 times. As the weeks and months went by, I got really fucking big. After I had Marnie, I weighed over 14 stone. I'm short and I've got a small frame, so I've got nowhere to hide any extra weight. I looked like an Oompa Loompa. I didn't embrace it, not for a second. I hated it. But whatever I felt personally about that weight, and I lost a lot of it pretty quickly once I'd had Marnie, even if the last bit didn't shift until after I started substituting meals with alcohol and drugs again, I still resented being made to feel like I was too heavy for my job, and that if I didn't lose the extra pounds then I was failing in some way. I resented that I was expected to be feminine and sexy, yet instantly erase any traces of what my female body had been through carrying and birthing 3 babies in quick succession. It was that message that I was trying to deliver in the video for Hard Out Here. Boy, did I get that wrong. The acclaim for the song turned quickly to criticism. 24 hours after the video was released, Suzanne Moore wrote a takedown piece in The Guardian. "I like Alan's voice and presence and mouthiness," she wrote, "but I don't like racism. Even tongue-in-cheek, hand-on-slap black buttocks racism." In the video, Alan walks away from her twerking dancers. She remains in charge. They don't. Maybe I've read it wrong, but what I see is the black female body, anonymous and sexualized, grinding away to make the rent. We are not post-racism any more than we are post-feminism. This is the context into which this video falls. A white, middle-class woman playing ringleader to anonymous black women. Maybe there is a knowing wink here I missed. But I haven't missed years of black women writing about how their bodies are used for white people to write their own scripts all over them. There it was. A woman I admired was calling me a racist. I was racist because there were more black women than white women in the video wearing fewer clothes than white me. Fuck. I hadn't even noticed the racial makeup of the dancers. They were the choreographer's regular dance troupe, and she, a well-known black choreographer called Suzette Brissett, had cast them because they were good, and they knew the moves and the routine that she was after. That was the basis on which they were chosen. In fact, if you're counting, the lineup of dancers comprises 2 black women, 2 white women, and 2 Asian women. I was wearing more clothes than them, because I just had a baby. The dancers didn't want to be in saggy black leggings, and that wasn't the point anyway. The point was that women recording artists are all too often supposed to have the bodies of professional dancers, which was the kind of body I did not have, and dressed like them too. I felt that if I wore the same hot pants as the dancers, the story would have been about my love handles rather than about the song's message. But you can shout about your intentions behind a piece of work and justify your choices until kingdom come. What matters is how the work turns out and how it is perceived. If you try and put out music with a message that delivers more than bland banalities, then you can't also claim naivety, though I do claim it, with regret. I was upset by the negative reactions to Hard Out Here. One woman, a poet called Diana Roger, performed a spoken word response to the video and uploaded it online. She cried while she performed her piece, because I'd upset and offended her so much. I was livid when I first saw Roger's video because I felt like she was using me to make a bigger point, a point I agreed with and that I was trying to make and get across in the video. But once I'd got over feeling defensive, I listened to what she had to say. What she said made me adjust and shift my thinking. It made me realise that my naivety over the video and the reaction to it was the privilege of being a white woman. As a result, I began to read about intersectional feminism. I began to learn more, and I began to look at my output in a more responsible and considered way. That's what happened in the long term. I learned and grew from negative experiences, my fuck-ups, and the shit that I had to deal with. In the short term, as 2013 turned into 2014, I was too busy dealing with the fuck-ups that arrived one after another to think much at all. Isolation. Fuck-up number one happened as my management team and I were planning the Sheezus tour. My booking agent in 2013 and for many years before that was a guy called Alex Nightingale, who, as well as looking after and planning all my live work, my main source of income, was a close friend of mine and Ethel's godfather. I lived in the flat below him in Queen's Park and we saw each other all the time, but he'd been behaving erratically for a while. He was taking a lot of drugs, and that became an issue when it came to negotiating my live work. It reached the point where I had to tell him that I didn't think things were working between us professionally, and that I was now meeting other agents to discuss working with them. I didn't relish having this conversation with Alex. I dreaded it, hated it, and for a long time I avoided it, but it became imperative. And having to hear what I had to say, I think, sent Alex into a spin of unprofessionalism that resulted in my lawyer Kieran having to fire him. Alex screamed at him, then wept. He shouted and begged. He was defiant one moment, pleading the next. He got down on his hands and knees and crawled about. He ranted and raved. I knew Alex then retreated into his flat to take drugs alone, staying up all night, night after night. But even so, I was surprised when he began the process of suing me for unfair dismissal and loss of earnings. "I want £1 million before I walk away," he told my lawyer. And it was an absurd figure. He said that before he was fired, he'd been speaking to a company about an arena tour for me that was worth £10 million. £10 million fucking pounds. Get a grip. There are bands who do £10 million arena tours, but you've got to charge people £120 a ticket and have tens of thousands of people coming to each and every gig to make that kind of deal work. I'm Lily Allen, not Coldplay or Pink Floyd. I can't fill a huge arena night after night. Everyone wanted to do the right thing by Alex and no one wanted a lawsuit. Wearily, we began the process of trying to work things out the hard way, which mostly meant paying my lawyer huge sums of money in order to pay Alex a huge sum of money so that he, in turn, could give most of it to his lawyer. I didn't want to go to court. It was the new year. I had my third album ready for release and was planning a long tour. Being sued by your friend and colleague is a sad and worrying way to start 9 months of working on the road. My beloved godfather Roger was also ill with liver cancer. Compared to Roger's illness, I felt like the mess with Alex could be solved. It would just take money. I paid Alex, and then I paid my lawyer £150,000. I paid for it with money that I'd set aside for my tax bill and hoped that I'd make enough new cash to pay that bill once it was due. I didn't. I paid the tax bill by going into debt. In April, I had to leave Sam and my girls to go to America and rehearse the show for the Sheezus tour. I found it hard to leave. I wanted the girls to come with me, but Sam felt that the world of sound stages and tour buses wasn't a stable environment. You do see sometimes entire families on tour, pop star parents travelling on a family bus and insisting on a kind of makeshift stability while they are on the road. Many crew workers are family men and women, and not everyone chooses to party, but Sam had a point. Together we decided it'd be better for all of us if I went on tour alone, while Sam lived between Overtown and London, running his building business. I would hit the road and earn the money and pay for the nannies. It's daunting gearing up for many months on the road. You got to make sure you can hold a show, give people a good time, get on with your band, stay on the straight and narrow, not descend into loneliness, nor become wayward out of boredom or wanting to connect or from desperately missing intimacy. It seemed a tall order. I was nervous about pulling it all off. I was being sued, my godfather had just died, and I'd left my home and my family, but was trying to stay present for my kids by FaceTiming them in the middle of my night when they got out of bed and started their day. Then I was having to get up and put my show together. On top of all that, I had a week of family therapy in a clinic in Arizona to get through before my first gig. Our family was doing therapy for various reasons, but the fact was that we all needed to check in with each other. Me, Sarah, Alfie, Mum and Dad all felt that we weren't getting what we needed from each other, and we'd agreed that it was time to try and support each other more. It felt like a good idea to get help doing that, and to start talking about whatever had gone wrong over the years, in a calm way, on neutral territory, with a therapist making sure we could all have our voices heard.